Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the second meeting of the Task Force on Cadmium in Children's Jewelry. We are very pleased today to be actually able to use a technology in this building called Skyping, which is a very happy occurrence because with this complex a subject, getting people here on short notice is terribly difficult. But we have two presenters today. They have been recommended by members of the panel or the task force, and we are truly pleased to be able to have the expertise that is represented in our two presenters. A little housekeeping, Representative Ed Vargas cannot be here today. He has a family emergency. John Newman can't be here, and Anthony DeGeorge, as well as Thomas Metzel. So it's wonderful that CTN, and I would remind people that this is being televised by CTN, so please do turn on your microphones when you speak. It's wonderful that CTN is covering this because it will be available to our task force members as well as the public. And they are now archiving these, which is wonderful, so they're available, I suppose, in perpetuity. With that, in case I've forgotten anything, and also to turn the microphone over to my co-chair to see if he has any remarks.
Thank you. Just a quick few. I want to thank our staff, Liz and Angel, for coordinating this meeting this afternoon. As Representative Urban said, this is new technology for us, and it's amazing that we have two esteemed guests who are addressing us from far away, and I'm kind of excited to see how this works, and hopefully it will be flawless. I also wanted to ask the members of the task force, if you are here, if you could turn your name tags so it's facing that way so that we can sort of see who you are until we learn everybody's names. That would be great. And I think what we're going to try and accomplish today is to give our speakers up to 10-15 minutes to make a presentation and then have opportunities for questions. We are on a schedule, however, because the second speaker will be going on around 3 o'clock or so. So we do have 45 minutes for our first guest. And I will turn it back to my co-chair to open the meeting.
Thank you, Representative Barham. And we are really pleased to have Mr. Alan Kaufman, who's the Senior Vice President of the Toy Industry Association. Everyone has your resume in front of them, Mr. Kaufman. If you would care to give us a brief overview of your experience, that's we'd be thrilled to hear that. But I do want you to know that they do have your resume in front of them. And with that, I turn it over to you. We just have to wait a second, Mr. Kaufman, because we don't have sound. And Angel, our committee clerk, is attempting to get sound. Mr. Kaufman, just hold on one second. We're going to try to get IT here, but every so often you could, like, say hi, and then we'd know whether we could hear you. Yeah, we can't hear you. You can hear us. Is that correct? Could you, Mr. Kaufman, if you could nod your head if you could hear us. Can you hear us? Could you nod your head, Mr. Kaufman, if you could hear us? Yeah, I don't think he can hear us, guys. For those of you who are watching, we are now communicating with signs. No, he's still not. Could you try talking again?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Woohoo! Awesome!
Okay, great.
And so now I will turn the meeting over to you, Mr. Kaufman.
If I could just ask a favor, if anyone in the room is speaking, if you could bring the microphone close to you because the echo and the lag on the internet connection is making it difficult to understand. I can hear you talking, but it's difficult to understand the words if you're too far away from the microphone. Good afternoon. My name is Alan Kaufman. I'm Senior Vice President of Technical Affairs for the Toy Industry Association. I was a member of the work group and the F-1524 subcommittee that developed the ASTM standard F-2923 for children's jewelry. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why we took the approach that we did. With regard to the standard, and it was that we made a conscious decision not to utilize a total lead or cadmium standard, but rather to use what we call a soluble or a migratable lead and cadmium standard or cadmium standard for children's jewelry. And the reason we did this was that much more closely indicate the risk from exposure, and I'll explain a little bit as to why. If you think about it, heavy metals in products typically don't exist as the metal itself. They are usually a compound of that metal. And when a child, let's say, if they were to ingest part of a product, it would go into the stomach, and it would be subjected to an acid environment in the stomach, and that would cause those compounds to do what chemists would call dissociate. It would break it up into its component ions. And different compounds dissociate to different degrees. They become soluble or migratable, or if you want to think about it this way, bioavailable. To differing degrees depending on the particular compound that is involved. In addition, there are what we would term matrix effects. For instance, it is much easier to extract a heavy metal from a very thin paint film than it would be from a thick piece of plastic. And the reason is that acid doesn't appreciably attack that plastic to any degree, and so whatever heavy metals are available are typically those molecules which are sitting on the surface of that piece of plastic. And so therefore, for those reasons, that soluble approach makes is a much better approximation of what the true risk is and what the true exposure would be. And in fact, we mimicked the heavy metals requirements that are in the current TOI standard, which is now federal law, with regard to extraction and solubility of cadmium and other heavy metals, but also the European Union requirement for TOIs as well. They likewise employ a soluble approach. And again, I think there's general agreement that this is a much better approximator of what the true risk is. The requirement for lead in the U.S. Originally started out as a requirement for paint. And as I said, the availability of heavy metals from paint is quite a bit different than it would be in a solid matrix, regardless of what the material is. And for that reason, we elected to go with that soluble approach. That's essentially the gist of my presentation. So I think at this point, I'll open it up to any questions that the panel might have.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Kaufman. And I am Diana Urban. I am the chair of this task force, along with Representative Barham. I'm also chair of the Children's Committee. And I'm assuming you can hear me.
I can hear you. It's very difficult to understand. Let me ask you a question. Is it possible to open up a phone link as well? I'm happy. Is there a phone in the room? I'm happy to call you.
There is a phone, and we are going to ask our clerk if that can happen. I mean, I can't be much closer to the mic. Yeah. Maybe we are on the cell phone. He's doing it. Angel has it. Yeah. We're going to try.
Something. Okay. Yes, it is. I'm sorry. I am in the middle of a conference call. Sorry. How often?
Hi.
That's much better. Thank you.
All right, then I am.
Turn off your mic.
Well, don't we have to have it on for CPN?
Hear us?
Very simply, in looking at the ASTM standard, it became obvious to me that there were no testing based on whether the jewelry had been subjected to wear and tear. And knowing little children and how they treat their jewelry, it's very often the jewelry is pounded on. It's tried to make it into something else. They chew on it. They do certain things with it. So I was wondering why there is no testing based on what would the bioavailability of the cadmium when the jewelry has been subjected to wear and tear. And I have seen some data where it's tested the jewelry not subjected to wear and tear, and there is significantly less availability of the cadmium. And when you look at it when the jewelry has been subjected to wear and tear, the curves just jump in a positive slope. So that would be my first question. I actually have four questions, and then I'll turn it over to my co-chair or my task force member. So that's the first one.
And frankly, the wear and tear issue, if you think about a solid piece of, let's say, metal jewelry, it's going to be relatively homogeneous. And so even if it's subjected to wear or abrasion, I wouldn't expect that you would see a significant difference in the amount of cadmium that might be available. The situation you're describing sounds as if the jewelry
That was my co-chair.
Okay.
I'm just turning the mic on so people can hear you.
All right.
Can you still hear us if I have this mic on, or is it echoing?
No, that's fine.
Okay, good. All right, so we did move on.
So, and the requirement that we have in place is intended. In fact, we actually spoke with the CGSC technical staff who were part of the subcommittee, and they, in consultation with them, the feeling was that the requirement for that long test in the simulated acid medium would be sufficient to address that issue. For instance, if you had a plating material which would be subject to attack, but you need the acid long enough that you would get through that plating and expose any underlying cadmium.
Well, you know, that's really great, because that actually brought up my second question. My second question is when you do put it in that acidic environment, which presumably is mimicking a child actually swallowing the charm or the, you know, whatever piece of jewelry it is, that test anticipates a 24-hour exposure within the child's body. And yet, in talking with pediatricians, et cetera, that is not necessarily the length of time that it will stay where it is bioavailable. It depends upon the child. It depends upon what the child's been ingesting before that. And I have gotten, I have gotten times that go from 3 days to 2 weeks, where before that piece of jewelry is expelled by the body. So I'm interested in why it was 24 hours was chosen as a, you know, maximum amount of time that piece of cadmium would be exposed and bioavailable in the child's body.
And you're absolutely right. In other words, the average residence time in the stomach, you know, if you were to swallow most objects, would be maybe around 6 hours. However, there is the possibility, particularly if you've got something that's fairly heavy, that it could stay in the stomach for several days. However, if you think about it, again, that approach of 24 hours of extraction was intended to assure that you would get through any kind of overlying plating and get to the underlying metal if you had a plated metal piece. And once you've gotten to that underlying metal, in terms of trying to determine whether you've got a significant amount of cadmium that's bioavailable, you would know that. In other words, a simple way to put it would be going beyond 24 hours really didn't buy you anything additional. In other words, you would know at the end of 20.
Because I do things from an economist's perspective, that to me would be making an evaluation at the margin. And you know, an evaluation at the margin is a difficult evaluation to make numerically and with any certainty. So when we're talking about a toxic heavy metal, and we're talking about children whose bodies are rapidly growing, and whose hormones and body innards are changing, whose brain development is ongoing, I'm not sure that I feel confident that 24 hours is going to satisfy the substrate and then the total product content. The 300 parts per million is a total product content number. And then if the jewelry itself exceeds that 300 parts per million in total product content, then it is subjected to a test. So I'm not sure I understand your point about it not being bioavailable if it stays in the child's system longer than 24 hours. Are you suggesting that...
Let me try it this way. You have to separate what will happen in the child's stomach from what would happen in the test. And remember that the test is really only a way of trying to determine whether you've got a component that presents a risk or not. And so the fact that the test is 24 hours, you know, really, I'm not disputing the fact that if something stays in the child's stomach longer than 24 hours, that there may potentially be a continued extraction of cadmium. What we are saying is that based on some empirical data that was developed by the CPSC technical staff, the extraction rate or the migration rate of cadmium is so low, and the 24-hour test was found to be sufficient experimentally to get through any kind of a plating. They did testing on a number of components in order to arrive at that number. So what we're saying is that 24 hours is sufficient from the standpoint of a test to tell you you've got too much cadmium. And the reason that 300 part per million threshold was put in place was really to make sure that you weren't testing items that couldn't possibly make enough cadmium bioavailable to create an issue. So as we know that the migration rate of cadmium is, you know, on the order of a few percent. So if you have a total content less than 300 parts per million, it was calculated that you would never get to that 200 micrograms, which is considered to be, you know, the dose which is of concern. And so that's the reason we arrived at it. So we think that regardless of the fact that something might stay in the stomach longer, 24 hours is certainly enough to tell you that you have an item with a problem, and that's why we set the standard that way.
Now, so this is really, and it's very interesting because each time you answer me, it brings up my next question. So my next question is, presumably, in order to produce this jewelry, there needs to be a certain amount of a toxic heavy metal cadmium in the jewelry. Because that's otherwise we wouldn't even be having this discussion because we just wouldn't have it unless it was background, which we do know there is a certain amount of background cadmium that is trace amounts. So my question is how much can we reduce the amount of cadmium in children's jewelry before it fails? And the reason I'm asking this question is I've seen studies on jewelry that have 75 parts per million in cadmium, and those pieces of jewelry have not failed. So I would be very interested in what level of cadmium that we is necessary before the jewelry, and maybe that's not the precise term in jewelry, but it's the term I'm using, fails.
And frankly, I'm going to defer that question to someone from the jewelry industry because I'll be honest. I certainly understand the details of testing, and I understand the toxicological implications. I'm not a jewelry manufacturing expert.
Fair enough. So this will be my last question, and I'm sure that there are members of the task force. You mentioned the European Union have come up with a standard for toys. Is that standard 100 parts per million?
The standard for cadmium, bear with me 1 second, and I will confirm what it is. And it, remember, it's a soluble limit. It's not a...
total product content.
That's not a total product content.
Well, Mr. Kaufman, we actually have questions for the record, so if you would like to get back to us on that, we can do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I believe it's 75 parts per million soluble.
Soluble.
But, I can't confirm that right this moment.
Okay. And then I just end with an observation as, you know, somebody who does research. Some of the issues I had with the F2923 standard was there were words used like quite low, average, and assumed 3% migration rate. When you're doing research, quite low and average, terms like that are difficult if you're studying it. So I do see that Mutual Cornell has done these tests, so I would ask our clerks to please get us a copy of those tests so that we have the actual numbers. We don't have low and average is always a difficult one because average means there can be 90% and, you know, 10%, and we end up with an average that's in the middle. So I'm not real happy with average results. With that, I'll turn it over to my co-chair to see if he has any questions.
Thank you very much. I'm Representative David Barham. And I co-chair the General Law Committee. We have two committees here that comprise this task force, as well as a number of laypersons and experts from different segments of our community. Since I really have no background, not being a chemist or an economist, I'm just a lawyer, I'm going to ask questions on a more lay level. So the first question is, you talked about a solubility standard and a total content. Is there a conversion factor so that if we're looking at solubility, we can determine what that means in terms of total content? So if you said 75 parts per million is the European Union standard, I could know how much higher or lower that is than the 300 parts per million.
And the short answer is no, unfortunately. In fact, that would be the holy grail if we could find that. But unfortunately, there are two variables that correlation to vary considerably, and those are the matrix that the material is contained in. Some matrices are more easily attacked by the acid in the stomach, and therefore more of the heavy metal might become bioavailable. The other issue is what particular species that you're dealing with. In other words, because you're not dealing with just the metal, you're dealing with a compound of that metal. And probably the best way I can think of it is in terms of lead, if you think about lead acetate, it's extremely soluble, and so a fairly high proportion of that lead would be potentially bioavailable. On the other hand, if you had something like lead sulfate, it's much less soluble, much less dissociated by the acid, and therefore much less of the lead is available to the body. And so both of those factors interacting mean that the, all I can tell you is that the soluble level is typically lower than the total level, but as far as a conversion factor, there really isn't one.
Okay. With regard to the issue of how much content there should be and what the standard should be, in terms of actual empirical evidence, do we have a list of how many children in various countries or throughout the world have actually ingested this material and what kind of reactions they've had, so that, you know, we can hear the scientific standards, but the practical application for those countries that may have the 300 parts per million versus something, you know, more scrutinizing, do we have any evidence of what the impact is on children?
Well, I think there are some data available in terms of what would pose an acute toxic dose of various compounds of cadmium. But in terms of the blood cadmium levels, for instance, and how that correlates with various countries' requirements, I don't believe those data exist. In fact, most of the data on exposure comes from occupational exposures to cadmium.
Okay. There has also been some question about the Jewelry Association's task force that studied this, I believe, for a year and a half and came to conclusions. Could you tell us a little bit about the composition of the task force? Was it made up of a diverse segment of the population, different expertises, or was it more focused in terms of the jewelry industry and to the exclusion of others? And the second part of that is, it's my understanding that the United States Product Safety Commission adopted this standard or endorsed it. If you could tell us a little bit about that as well.
Yes, and first of all, you know, even though the FJATA was the impetus behind the standard, the standard was actually developed under the auspices of ASTM International, which is an independent third-party standards development organization. And ASTM has very specific rules as to the makeup of subcommittees and committees, and they require a certain amount of balance. And so there has to be an appropriate balance between industry and what they call producer interests and general interests, and also consumer interests. So the makeup of this subcommittee was fairly diverse. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission technical staff, both from chemistry and from toxicology, did participate. I think we had representatives, if I remember correctly, from Health Canada as well, who were on the committee, on the subcommittee. We had consumer representatives, the danger, and I believe several others. I believe environmental health was part of it. So there were a number of organizations that are consumer oriented that were on the subcommittee. In addition, there were some industry representatives as well. But ASTM has rules in terms of at least the voting membership of the committee. I mean, anybody is welcome to join a subcommittee meeting. To be a voting member, you have to join ASTM, which I think costs $75 a year. However, ASTM will not count every voting member or every ASTM member's vote in making sure that there is balance in terms of the vote, so that no one group can predominate and no one group can dominate a subcommittee.
So when you concluded your review and voted to accept this standard of 300 parts per million, was it a unanimous vote? Was it a strong consensus? Was there a vocal minority? Can you tell us a little bit about the adoption?
I would recommend you speak with ASTM to get the exact figures, but my recollection is that there was near unanimous acceptance of the standard. I believe there were a couple of negative votes, which were found to be non-persuasive, and the reason is that I believe a couple of individuals felt that a total standard was preferable because it was easier to measure. There was no argument that it was necessarily more protective, but it was more about it being easier from a measurement standpoint. I believe those were found to be non-persuasive. Those non-persuasive votes were ratified by the full F-15 Consumer Products Committee, which likewise is subject to those balance requirements.
my last question, you referenced a TOI standard, and I just was a little confused whether the TOI standard is the same as the cadmium standard, and if not, what would be the reasons for the differences?
Yes, the TOI standard I was referring to is ASTM F963, and actually the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008 actually made that a mandatory federal rule. Yes, they did, because it was a TOI standard. That standard was in existence and did not include jewelry, it included toys.
Now, Mr. Calhoun, sorry, I said that and people probably didn't hear me.
Was that, and you just verified that was a TOI standard, not a jewelry standard.
Yes, and that standard was in effect for many years. In fact, that is the sort of the latest iteration of a standard that goes back to 1976. The toy industry developed a voluntary standard that far back that limited heavy metals. And the jewelry standard started out with that TOI standard, but the TOI standard was, to a certain extent, a little bit constrained in that, in addition to making sure that it was sufficiently protective, we also had the desire to try to minimize testing costs by aligning with the European Union standard to the greatest extent that we could. The jewelry standard, because there was no corresponding European Union standard for jewelry, had a little more freedom, and frankly, I think the approach that was taken by the jewelry subcommittee strikes an appropriate balance between protectiveness and making sure that you weren't testing products that were known not to create an issue by using that total approach.
Thank you very much. I don't have any other questions. I was going to make one suggestion, though, for task force members who want to ask questions. I'd be happy to let you sit in my seat so that our guests can see you on his computer, and you can talk into the phone. And so I'm going to get up and move somewhere else for a moment. And I would suggest when Representative Urban calls on you, maybe you come over here and sit for a moment and ask your questions. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
No, but I'm not sure if your voice will carry into the phone.
You want to try one, Lou, and see if he can get it?
Mr. Coffin, are you able to hear me?
Unfortunately, no.
How about now? Nope. Okay.
There's a real echo.
Okay. Why don't you take my seat, Lou? No, it's fine.
Now, that was testing 1, 2, 3. Is there anyone who would care to come sit next to me?
Everybody.
Gary? Hey, wait a second. What do you mean they're afraid?
Yeah.
And following Gary would be Brent. And then following Brent would be Lou? No? You? Okay, Lou, okay.
Hi, Mr. Kaufman. I'm Gary Ginsberg, toxicologist. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with the paper by Wiedenhammer, 2011. He'll be the speaker after you, and I just thought I'd go over some data from that article with you. Have you had the chance to read it?
Actually, I read it when it first came out, but I have not looked at it in some time.
Okay, I won't ask you details, just sort of general themes from his data, because it seems to contradict, and we'll have a chance to talk to him about his data, of course, next, but it seems to contradict some of your statements. So, for example, they've got a graph that shows that in the first 24 hours from a damaged sandal charm, there's not a lot of extraction in some of the replicates, and then it takes off after 24 hours, which would be a much different time frame than you were saying the test was adequate for. And another element of their data is the high variability in duplicates from the same sandal charm. They ran, it looks like, 5 or 6 of the same thing, and the results were all over the place, and they do talk about that in their article, which does, in my mind, question the reliability of the standard. They say here that they're running it according to the ASTM method.
And when they say high variability, in terms of results, in other words, the amount of cadmium or the amount of time that it takes for the continued to start declining?
Well, for example, in Figure 1C, they've got an undamaged heart charm sample that after 100 hours of acid, dilute acid extraction, they've got several replicates that are, looks like maybe 5,000 micrograms extracted, and then two samples that are up over 60,000. And the curves, you know, are consistent over time. Several of the replicates are very high extraction, others, you know, barely anything on this scale.
All right. I'd be speculating here, but I would have to assume that the variation the differences in plating thickness, because that is the only plausible reason that I can think of why you would see very little cadmium extracted at the beginning of the test and then have it start to climb. If you had a plating over a substrate which contained a large amount of cadmium or a high content of cadmium.
Excuse me, but why would that matter if it's the same sample being extracted in six different little replicates? How would the plating, would you think the plating would vary that much from one to the other? And if that is true, that still does beg the question of how reliable is any random off-the-shelf test for 24-hour digestion if this could be that variable based upon some surface plating from one replicate to the next?
Well, the only thing I can tell you is that the decision to go with the 24-hour test was based on empirical data that was developed by the CPSC staff. They had done their own experimentation and felt very comfortable that the 24-hour extraction would get us through the plating in certainly a wide variety of items that they tested. I guess the only other thing I would say is that since Dr. Wiedenhammer's paper came out in 2011, that was prior to the widespread adoption of this standard, and I would have to theorize that you probably wouldn't see similar results today.
And what has changed?
The standard is out there and is being followed by the industry.
Okay, so let me ask a practical question. So let's say that in Connecticut we go with the ASTM standard. How would it practically work? Let's say that we found something that on XRF had 1,000, you know, above 300. Then what happens?
Then you would subject it to the 24-hour acid extraction test and measure the amount of soluble cadmium.
So we would have to have a lab contracted set up that could run the ASTM method and at the state's expense test the samples that we have a concern about?
Yes, if you decided that was something that the state needed to do. But keep in mind, if you're proposing that the alternative is to measure total content and to do it based on standard XRF, I would caution that XRF is really a terrific screening method.
Mm-hmm.
I've got quite a bit of experience with standard XRF, and I found that it's subject to a very high rate of false positives. So that if it tells you that nothing is there, you can pretty much take that to the bank. On the other hand, if you have a result indicating that there is some cadmium or other heavy metals there, good practice would dictate that you verify that by wet chemistry.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily mean an extraction test. That just means that it is part of our screen that we would then have to verify the XRF result and determine whether in our minds that represents a lot of cadmium in the piece of jewelry. Beyond that, you're suggesting that then we'd have to send it, that we'd have to have that lab do a solubility test. And based upon this data, it looks like we'd have to run that test at least 5 or 10 or who knows how many times. To see the range of variability in the result, which might be expensive.
Well, but you'd also have to verify the XRF data on total cadmium. You'd also have to do a complete digestion of the material. You basically have to digest it in concentrated acid in order to determine what the total content of cadmium is by wet chemistry. So in terms of cost, there's not a significant difference.
Doesn't it represent a different test? I mean, the total digestion test you just mentioned versus then doing a 24-hour extraction test, wouldn't that be separate tests?
Well, you would not have to do, if there were no total content test, in other words, if you got to 300 parts per million by XRF, then you know the recommendation would be to proceed to the soluble test. But what I'm saying is, if you determine that you wanted to set a standard which was a total limit, I would not rely on the results from XRF to determine whether something was passing or failing.
Thank you very much.
I'd remind our task force members that we have another speaker coming in at 3, and I don't want to limit anybody, but if we could not repeat anything. And Brent, I believe that you're next.
Hello, Al.
Hi, Brent. How are you?
Good. Brent Cleveland here. I thank you for your explanation on the 24-hour test, in that in 24 hours of this acid bath, that if cadmium were going to come out at harmful levels, then it would show 200 micrograms at the end of that 24-hour period, which was really the whole meaning for that test. So the fact that if something generated more micrograms than 200 after 24 hours, it could go to 10,000, but yet it would still fail the standard. I thought that was an excellent explanation. But in further clarification, could you explain the paint and surface coating level of cadmium requirement in the ASTM standard?
Yes, the paint and surface coating requirement is the same as what was used in the TOI standard, and it is, I believe, 75 parts per million soluble after a two-hour extraction test. And the reason that only 2 hours is sufficient there is because when you're talking about paint films, they're easily digestible or easily attacked by the acid. And also, you have a very high surface-to-volume ratio, so it's easy to get at whatever cadmium may be there.
Great, and I think that's very important to realize that there are different pathways for exposure and there's different elements of risk with the particular elements involved. That was my point. Thank you, Al. I will defer to another question.
Thank you. And I think Representative Esposito? Yes, thank you. Okay.
Good afternoon, Al.
Good afternoon.
Again, I'm nowhere near the level of the two previous speakers, but the questions I have for you, is there a difference in stomach acid between a grown-up and a child?
Not that I'm aware of. The standard that is used is 0.07 normal, which translates to a pH of about 1.5 to 2, to my understanding, is similar in both adults and children.
I mean, that's just so I could get a feel for if the test is more geared toward a grown-up or toward a child, but that's fine. And you mentioned before about the TOI standard. Do any of the TOIs that were tested contain any cadmium? Just going back at some time.
I think maybe at one time in the distant past, it was common to see, occasionally cadmium red pigments that were used in plastics. I think for a variety of reasons, industry has moved almost completely away from those types of materials and gone to materials which may not be, let's say, as light fast as some of those inorganic pigments, but clearly present much less of a toxicity issue.
All right, because I know there are toys that are made with various metals for children, so I was just wondering if the cadmium would be present in any other type of toy other than what you just described.
Not very likely. Most metal that you would find in toys would be either cold rolled steel, with maybe a nickel plating, or would be die cast zinc aluminum alloy.
Okay. And lastly, when they're doing the acid test, I imagine they're letting something sit in a container and again, I'm paraphrasing from my perspective, but do they take into account the flushing of the human system at the same time? If a child were to ingest a toy, not a toy, but a jewel, and if he's eating and drinking fluids, would that make a difference in the absorption rate of the body?
It could, but it would be likely to reduce it. In other words, that as you add materials which would tend to dilute the acid that's in the stomach, you would reduce the impact. So to a certain extent, that acid extraction test sort of represents a worst case. In other words, it's thinking about an empty stomach that's got the full-strength acid in it. And just so you're aware, that test is 2 hours, but the first hour requires constant agitation to simulate the peristaltic action of the stomach. So assuming that the stomach, which is fairly muscular, is going to be moving, and it's going to be moving that material around, there is agitation for the first hour, and then it's allowed to stand for an additional hour.
All right, but that goes to my question, is that the test is based strictly on what's being tested at that point. There's no flushing of the fluids that are part of the test, like the human body would do normally. A child or an adult would drink fluids or eat food, and that would move everything through the system and flush out part of what's being,
taken. In other words, that the material would move on out of the stomach?
Correct.
Yes, it actually just, it sort of assumes that it sits there for 24 hours, which, is possible. It has happened, but as I said, the average residence time for most materials in the stomach is about 6 hours.
Okay, thank you.
And we do have one more question from Senator Whitcomb.
Hi, Al. My question to you is, there's a product that's made with a multiple number of chemicals and compounds. When it's broken out through the testing, does it matter the combination of the materials that were made to compromise the final product, or that doesn't matter because the tests break it down to its own individual entity?
In other words, is it, if I understand your question correctly, is the presence of more than one, let's say, heavy metal, does that impact the measurement of those, of others?
Correct.
It can, in terms of XRF. There can be some interferences, although cadmium is not terribly subject to it. But there, for some of the other heavy metals that we look for, there can be interferences, and that's one of the reasons why you should always, if you get a failing result, you should always always verify that by wet chemistry. On the other hand, for wet chemistry, because what's typically done is a technique called ICP, OES, which is inductively coupled plasma optical emission spectroscopy. What they do is they put the material into a plasma field, and each of the elements actually emits at a specific wavelength, and so it's very easy to tell one element from another.
And when is that test determined, upon failure, or how do you know when to move on to that particular type of a test?
When you get to the 300 parts per million total cadmium that you can measure quickly and easily using XRF, if you're 300, then you would move to that soluble test to make sure that you weren't going to extract more than 200 micrograms of cadmium.
Thank you.
We really appreciate your being with us. I'm sure that we could go on and on and on with questions, but we do have another presenter, so I'd simply go over so that we're clear on the task force. The questions for the record were the exact European Union number, whether it's 75 parts per million and 100 parts per million, that we would like a reference, and I believe maybe it's available in the ASTM standard. If it is, you can just email us and tell us that, the Mutual Cornell study. And the final one, which I guess is an ASTM standard question, and I'm not sure where to go with that, which was how much cadmium does a product need or jewelry product need before it fails? And I think you referred us to the ASTM
Actually, I think FJAGA could probably put you in touch with someone who may be able to answer that question for you.
It's so great when we talk in acronyms. FJ, what is that precisely?
Sorry, the
Fashion, Jewelry,
and Accessories Trade Association.
Okay, Fashion, Jewelry, and Accessories Trade Association for my clerks. We've got that? Excellent. Thank you so much, and thank you for bearing with us in our first attempt to Skype from the Connecticut Legislature.
This actually worked very well, so thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. I guess we're going to turn this over to the clerks to get us to our next presenter. Angel? For those of you wondering, Dr. Weidenheimer is in Spain, so we're waiting for this to, I guess, get across the Atlantic Ocean. Our committee clerk is sending him an email as we are trying to get him to pick up, which will not happening. While we're waiting, are there any questions or comments from the task force that they'd like to wait? We have a tech person with us. I'll take up some of the silence now, which I was going to talk about, which I think is really interesting. For those of you who watch House, and I'm sure there are people at home that watch House, there is an episode, number 12, which was done in February 2005, and it's about an athlete who has symptoms. And, of course, you know how House operates. It's always a mystery. And they're trying to figure out why this incredible athlete has bone loss and his kidneys are shutting down and all kinds of things. So I'm not going to give away, but it does have something to do with cadmium. And he loved jewelry. So it's House Episode 12, February 22nd, 2005. Now, I don't know a thing I can say now. Actually, it was something else, Senator. You're going to have to go look.
Oh, could I raise a point of clarification?
Sure.
That in the ASTM standard, it starts with a limit on paint and surface coatings. And, of course, that is because the cadmium in paint would be more easily bioavailable than cadmium in any other material. So because of that, there's a 75 parts per million restriction, soluble testing, on paint and surface coatings. Then the standard requires migration testing to yield less than 200 micrograms and a 24-hour heated agitated test. If it has 300 ppm or lower total content, you don't need to test migration. So it's been kind of verbalized backwards, you know.
Ooh,
that you would test first the total content. Oh, here we go. Thank you.
No, we don't have
we'll finish.
I thought we had Dr. Wiedenheim.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Cool. Hi. Can you put on your camera, Dr. Wiedenheimer? Can you actually hear us?
Yes, hold on.
Oh, excellent.
Is that better?
Yeah, it looks like a stick figure to us. If necessary, Dr. Wiedenheimer, we can just listen. It looks like we're...
Hold on, my video went off for some reason, so...
Oh, there you are.
There you go.
Dr. Wiedenheimer, thank you so much for being with us. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I'm Diana Urban. I'm the chair of the Task Force on Cadmium and Children's Jewelry. Sitting next to me is my co-chair, David Barham, and we welcome you here, and we're going to let you introduce yourself. Rather, everybody has your resume in front of them, and it's clear that you have an enormous expertise in this area. So if you'd like to give us a short look at what your background has been, that's great, and then we just turn it over to you to talk to us about cadmium levels in children's jewelry.
Okay, thank you. Well, my comments I'm making based on having done some extensive testing of children's jewelry for both lead and cadmium, and having published the study, you have a figure from that study on cadmium bioavailability that was published in Environmental Health Perspectives. I would further point out that of the recalls of children's jewelry items for cadmium content and one additional warning about high cadmium content in jewelry that have been issued by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, three of those items were identified as hazardous through my lab, and I informed the commission of those results prior to their actions. The comments I have about the issue in front of you about children's health and the potential hazards of cadmium in children's jewelry, I make on the basis of my background is as an analytical chemist, not as a toxicologist, but I think there is some basic information on cadmium toxicity in the literature that underlies some of the concern that I have. I'm sure you're aware of some of this, and so I'll make this point very brief. Cadmium is, as you know, extremely toxic. It accumulates in the body. And a recent review by Jarup and Atkinson, detailed the issues that the primary concerns from chronic exposure are osteotoxicity, bone damage, and kidney damage, which typically would occur later in life, not normally with children. Their review also indicated, based on looking at the NHANES data maintained by the National Institutes of Health, that there's a significant fraction of the non-smoking population in the U.S., non-smoking because smoking is a significant route of cadmium exposure, but a significant fraction of the non-smoking population in the U.S. has cadmium levels high enough to measure impacts on kidney function. And they concluded in their study that this implies that there really is no margin of safety between current levels of exposure to trace levels of cadmium in the diet and from other sources, and levels that could adversely affect health. So part of my concern is that any exposure of children to cadmium early in life, therefore, would add to this already high level of exposure. The concerns I have, and I'll try and keep this brief and to the point, about the about the ASTM standard and the ASTM standard, as I understand it, assesses potential hazards of jewelry items that if they contain more than 300 parts per million of total cadmium, then they would be subjected to one of two tests for extractable cadmium. Small items would be tested by leaching in a dilute hydrochloric acid solution to simulate exposure to stomach acids. Larger items would be tested by measuring cadmium leaching into a saline solution, simulating what might happen if a child mouthed the high cadmium necklace. I've done both of these tests in the lab. The logic of them is that, you know, if the cadmium is in a form that can't be leached from the jewelry by mouthing or swallowing the item, then that there would not be a hazard. The fundamental problem with that standard, in my opinion, is that there really is no provision to test jewelry items that have experienced what might be called normal wear and tear of these jewelry items. If you damage the outer surface of an inexpensive children's jewelry item, as might be expected through abrasion, or if a child were to bite the item, that can change the characteristics of the item. But the ASTM standard does not give consideration to that possibility. In testing I've done, if you breach the outer electroplated coating, which most jewelry items typically have an outer coating that is electroplated varying thickness, breaching that coating can greatly change the characteristics of the item in terms of leaching. And I would note that there are other ASTM standards, for example, for children's items that contain magnets that mandate use and abuse testing. That's not mandated here. The data that is provided is taken from my study in environmental health perspectives. And these are for the sandal charms that are pictured in the photo that I supplied. These were purchased in 2008, but I have purchased other items more recently that still have high cadmium content. But I think the point is that this is an example of a children's jewelry item that would, as I understand it, pass the ASTM standard, but is still very, very hazardous. And so what you see here, the graphs on the left are for the results with six undamaged charms. These charms, on average, contain 39.1% cadmium, which would be 391,000 parts per million cadmium. On the left-hand side, the six undamaged charms, when they were tested by leaching in dilute hydrochloric acid for 24 hours, the average release was 121 micrograms, which would be below the 200 microgram threshold of the test. The two of the six items exceeded that value, but the average was below. When those items were damaged, and so there were six additional charms, similar total cadmium content, that were damaged by just putting a 1 to 2 millimeter cut in the item, the cadmium leaching from this item greatly increased. And you can see that on the right-hand side. After 24 hours, the average release was almost 1,600 micrograms for these items. And five of the six items were well above the 200 microgram threshold of the ASTM standard. The maximum release of cadmium in this for those items was over 3,000 micrograms, which would be extremely hazardous to a child. So this would be an example, in my opinion, of jewelry items that would pass the ASTM standard, but you know, normal wear and tear might result in very great cadmium exposures. The ASTM standard does not impose an upper limit on cadmium content of jewelry. And I think this is a serious concern because I've tested jewelry items that contain, in this case, the item was 39% cadmium, to items that were as high as 90% cadmium. And so damage to the outer coating, when you've got something that's 90% cadmium, there's a lot of potential cadmium that a child could be exposed to, particularly if they swallow the charm and it remains lodged in their stomach for days or a week or longer, as some of the recent evidence indicates that items that are swallowed can remain in the stomach for a long length of time. So that would be, I think, in summary, my concerns about the proposed change to the ASTM standard. I don't think that the ASTM standard takes into account all of the work that's been done on cadmium and jewelry, published by myself and others, and this lack of a limit on upper content is a very serious issue. I'll stop for there, and I'd be glad to address any questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wiedenhammer. And I would start out with my understandings on cadmium. It is a toxic heavy metal, and it's one that people are trying to get rid of. It's not one that people are trying to get more of. And witness that in 1990, we banned cadmium as well as mercury, lead, and hexavalent chromium from packaging material in Connecticut so it wouldn't end up in our water. So my question to you is cadmium a necessity to be used in jewelry, or was it a substitute when we passed the Consumer Product Safety Act and lead was highly regulated? Is it a substitute for lead? And can you speak to that?
Yes, I can try. I've analyzed a lot of jewelry items that contain very low levels of cadmium. So in that respect, I don't think it is essential to be in there. It will be, depending on the source material for the jewelry items, a contaminant of particularly, I think, some of the finer jewelry items where cadmium is in solders that it is difficult to eliminate entirely. But when the concern about lead in jewelry was identified, that was when we started seeing high levels of cadmium in some of this inexpensive children's jewelry. The source materials in China, the cadmium alloys were cheaper than other alternatives that might have been substituted for lead. And so because there were no regulations, because it was cheaper, apparently, that's why it got into jewelry in these amounts. And so I hope that it addresses your question.
It certainly does, because as an economist, those are the things that I'm always looking for. Why have we put cadmium, that is a toxic heavy metal, to children? Why would we even want it in great amounts or large amounts in jewelry? And you're... answer is what I would suspect, that when lead became highly regulated, they looked for an equally inexpensive substitute. So we're, again, trying to maximize profits on children's jewelry. Is there another substitute that's more expensive, like aluminum or something along those lines? I know nothing about chemistry. I'm just what is the substitute for cadmium?
Well, I think what you commonly find is that when lead was taken out of children's jewelry, many of the inexpensive jewelry items are composed primarily of zinc and copper.
zinc.
Cadmium, one of the attractive features of it, based on what I know, is that it does melt at a lower temperature than zinc, which makes it cheaper to use. It does make bright and shiny jewelry items. So I think it was simply a matter of low cost on being incorporated into these items. And the fact that, you know, there are, we do have examples now of a number of very high cadmium jewelry items makes this concern about an upper threshold on the amount to be allowed in the jewelry to be a significant concern.
I really appreciate your response, and I'm just going to end up with one last question, and I bring this up very often. We test for specific levels of a specific toxin, but there are multiple sources of cadmium, or there are synergistic effects of combining small cadmium exposures with exposures to other toxic chemicals. Is there any testing that you know of where they do try to test the synergy of multiple exposures to toxins, or is the testing always one toxin in separated from any other exposure, whether it be organophosphates with pesticides or polybrominated diphenyl ethers in fire material? Do you know of any testing where they try to look at the synergies?
It's really a question of toxicology, and I'm not, I'm speaking primarily as an analytical chemist, so I would have to defer to some of my colleagues who've done that low-level testing on those exposures. But I know there is work being done in that area, and I cannot speak specifically to that.
And I appreciate your response, and I would then turn this over to my co-chair, but I would mention that I heard two questions for the record. The first one was the recent review where you talked about the kidney issues. We would really like a reference on that study so that we could take a look at it ourselves where you started. And then the synergy is not a question for you, but one for the record for my clerks, because I would like to know the testing on any of the synergies on toxic chemicals. And with that, I turn it over to my co-chair.
Thank you, Doctor. And I'm David Barham. I'm the co-chair of this task force. This is a new topic for me, so I will probably ask a little simpler questions just to try and understand it from a layperson's perspective. But you talked about that if there's wear and tear on jewelry or a scratch, that the cadmium can migrate quicker and in higher levels. Wouldn't that be true regardless of what the content of the item was, that if something breaks down at all because of wear and tear, you're going to have a higher level of migration? So does it really matter what the content is?
Well, if your standard is based on how much cadmium leaches, and if that standard does not require breaching of that outer coating to determine the maximum amount of cadmium that can be released, then, I think the wear and tear does matter. You know, children, it's been well established that children will bite jewelry, and this inexpensive jewelry will be scratched and damaged. So when you don't have an upper limit on this, and we've got examples of pieces that are upwards of 35 to 90% cadmium, I think that is a concern from my standpoint.
I guess what I'm trying to suggest is if you have a piece of jewelry that has a certain level of content of cadmium in it,
yes,
versus a piece of jewelry that has a lower level content, and
right,
let's say there's a scratch on both of them,
right,
from a chemical perspective, does the leaching still occur in equal levels regardless of the initial content, so that if a piece of material passes through the stomach within 24 hours as an average, would it really matter whether a piece of jewelry had more or less cadmium content in it?
In my experience, the alloy content of the metal in the jewelry matters quite a bit, particularly for cadmium, much more so in my experience than for lead. So I've had some items that have a lower cadmium content that release a higher amount in these tests, and others that have a higher cadmium content that release a lower amount due to other elements that might be alloyed with the cadmium in the metal. If the concern is to have a standard that is protective of children's health, I guess that is where I would say the question would be to have some upper threshold on cadmium content to protect the health of children in this case. And that would be my suggestion, that there has to be some upper boundary.
Two of the standards that we have looked at are, one was passed by Connecticut a number of years ago, I believe it's 75 parts per million, and then there's the so-called industry standard of 300 parts per million. Is there any significant difference between those two standards from a health perspective, or as some have suggested, it's the, you know, diminutive in terms of the actual impact?
My testing has been done primarily on items that are significantly higher in content than even the 300 part per million standard. So I would need to, you know, I can't speak on the basis of having done extensive testing, say between 75 and 300 parts per million. I think you need to get some input from toxicologists that would have experience with what those low doses of cadmium might mean to a child. You know, I can say based on analytical work that in general, the pieces I've tested, I haven't seen a lot of difference when you're at that low a level. But the real issue with the 300 ppm limit in the ASTM standard is that if an item passes that leaching test, then there is no upper threshold. And the example I've provided to you, I think, demonstrates that that is an issue, that you've got a piece that's over 30% cadmium. If you don't damage that outer coating, it can pass that standard. But normal wear and tear could make that very dangerous and hazardous to a child.
So if I understand your testimony, your research and your primary concern has been on levels that are higher than the 300 parts per million and the fact that there's no upper level cap.
Yes, that's true.
One last question. The prior speaker gave some testimony with regard to the composition of this, trying to remember the acronym, of the Jewelry Safety Task Force, and he indicated it was fairly diverse. It had, you know, chemists and representatives from the industry and consumer rights groups, and that the decision in adopting this 300 parts per million was almost unanimous. Those were his words. I'm wondering if you have a problem with their conclusion with regard to the 300 parts per million, if that was adopted by states as a national standard, not to take away from your concern about states that don't adopt it that have higher levels, but would you feel comfortable with a 300 parts per million standard, and are you supportive of this recommendation?
I'm not wedded to a particular amount, whether it's 75 parts per million or another. I can't really make a strong argument between the 75 and the 300. However, I would say that, you know, this is an element that we know is
highly hazardous to children. And, you know, protecting their, you know, children's health, and given the what we know about the U.S. exposure levels to cadmium, that it makes sense to restrict potential exposures, unnecessary exposures, as much as possible. In my experience working with these items that have such a high amount of cadmium, you know, my experience on the analytical side has been biased by looking at those. But I think that is a very real problem with this proposed industry standard. It may have been adopted nearly unanimously by that committee, but I've provided data to you that shows that the industry standard does not clearly address the problem that's out in the marketplace that children could be exposed to, because these data are an example of an item that would pass that industry standard, but are clearly dangerous to a child. In terms of setting, you know, whether it's 75 parts per million or 300, again, I think you need to have the input of toxicologists who have some real expertise on trace metal exposures in children for that. If there is a threshold above which this leaching testing is done, it's going to be important how you specify to do that. Is there going to be wear and tear of the item that is a part of that analytical testing procedure? In my view, that was ignored by the ASTM committee, that issue. And the proposed standard is flawed on that basis based on the work that we have done. So I am concerned that the industry standard here really does not yet take into account all of the science on this. It's not just been work that I have done. There's a professor at the University of Montreal, Gerald Zagary, who has done work on this issue also. And I know from talking to him that he has some similar concerns.
Thank you very much for your candor. I appreciate your testimony.
Sure.
If I can just clarify, because we have people watching this on CTN, what you're saying is that it's the parts per million when we're talking 75, 100, 150, up to a certain level is not your major concern. What your major concern is that we are not in the ASTM standard looking at whether the jewelry has any wear and tear on it, and what the cadmium bioavailability becomes when there is wear and tear. And secondly, and I guess this might be a new question, is that the test for a child ingesting a charm, no, it's not a new question because I'm looking at your graph, is limited to 24 hours, and the charm actually might be in the child's system longer than that. So it's that's a two-part question. Dr. Wiedenhammer. One is the wear and tear, and the other is the 24 hours.
Yes. Clearly, the wear and tear is a major concern, I think. We know that wear and tear of the jewelry item can change the amount of cadmium that would be released from the item, and so that is a major concern on my part. On the, you know, the length of testing, the Consumer Product Safety Commission has based their threshold or recommended threshold for exposure based on a 24-hour exposure, in part due to the fact that there is this evidence that these items can stay in a child's stomach for a much longer period of time. The graphs that you have in the data I provided show you some indication of how much the exposures can go up as something remains in that solution over a period of time. The average length of time something may remain in the stomach may be 24 hours, but there are cases, depending on the size of the item, where we do know that the items can remain in the stomach for a longer period of time. There was a young boy in Minnesota that was lead poisoned several years ago. After swallowing a charm off of a charm bracelet, and that charm remained in his stomach for, I think it was at least 4 days. During that time, the lead dissolved, and he ultimately died of lead poisoning. So it's not a theoretical concern that something might remain in a child's stomach for that length of time. Ultimately, you do have to have some threshold in an analytical procedure, to have a standard. The concern here is that the standard that's been established is not necessarily protective enough of children's health, and that's my concern.
Thank you, and we're going to open it to questions, and I believe Dr. Ginsburg from the Department of Public Health has some questions. And my co-chair is actually giving up his seat, which is being a real gentleman, so that you'll be able to see Dr. Ginsburg as he talks to you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you by Skype, Dr. Wiedenhammer. And I read your article in Environmental Health Perspectives with great interest relevant to this task force. Just to clarify, I think, what the co-chair was trying to get at, and maybe I could put it into different words, if we follow the ASTM method, we would be allowing, theoretically, a piece of jewelry to have 391,000 parts per million of cadmium, which is what you tested and what's represented in these graphs, 391,000 parts per million of cadmium in the jewelry, and it would still pass the ASTM prescribed test, but as you demonstrate, could be very unsafe based upon some fairly minor scratches on it. Is that accurate?
I heard part of that question, but not all of it. Sorry.
Okay, we're going to switch.
Audio.
Can you hear me better now? Is this better?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I can.
Oh, it's the phone. Maybe
we don't have the phone.
We don't have the phone, but they heard you.
The phone tonight. Okay.
All right, let me try. Can you hear me now? Not. Is this all right?
Yeah, I can. I heard most of it. I apologize.
Can you hear from this mic any better?
Okay.
Okay.
So you're asking about my article in Environmental Health Perspectives and the method that was used?
No, I was just trying to summarize the point that the co-chair, Ms. Urban, was making, but putting it into different words to try to make the point clearer, I think. And that is that you tested a piece of jewelry that had 391,000 parts per million, not 75 or not 300, but 391,000. So many, many times higher. And you can't hear me? Are you able to hear? I think we've lost our mic here.
Sorry, I'm having a little trouble with the quality of the audio here. I did not completely get that.
Okay, we're trying to solve the audio problem, so just bear with us for a minute.
Okay.
Can you hear us?
Can you hear us? Doctor, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. It's
okay. We can hear you just fine. So maybe we'll just speak louder. You have to shout a little bit.
Okay.
Let me try it again. So I'm just trying to clarify your main point. You showed that a piece of jewelry with 391,000 parts per million would pass the ASTM method, but still had dangerous levels of cadmium leachable from it. Is that correct?
Okay. I showed that a piece of jewelry that had 391,000 parts per million of total cadmium, and after that,
would pass the ASTM test.
Didn't quite catch that, but so the piece of jewelry, the items that you have, 391,000 parts per million content, that those items did release the amounts of cadmium in the the dilute hydrochloric acid testing procedure that are shown.
But your point was that it would have passed the ASTM test. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I'm not catching that.
I don't know. Maybe my voice carries better. I'll try it. I think the question was that you tested something with 3,091 parts per million. 391,000 parts per million, and it passed the ASTM test, but it still had dangerous levels. Is that correct?
Okay, yes. Yes, if you did not damage that item, in fact, it would pass the ASTM test, and that's the data I've given you on the left-hand side. The damage to the outer coating, so these were not the identical items because I tested different items but had the same average levels of cadmium. If you damage that outer coating, you get very much higher levels of cadmium leaching from those items.
If I could just ask one follow-up question, it doesn't sound like it's just the scratching or the damage part, but it also looks like there's a lot of variability in your data. Can you speak to why the data are so variable?
Yes. We have seen quite a bit of variability in the data. I think that is due to two different factors. One is the electroplated coating on these items, in my experience, tends to be quite variable. And for the inexpensive jewelry items particularly, I think that is the case. The variation from item to item, I think, is due to the varying alloy content of other metals that are mixed with the cadmium. There is other data showing that, for example, depending on the zinc content of the alloy, that greatly affects the amount of cadmium that can be pulled off of it. Again, I think one has to presume that the items that might be sold in a situation are not going to have a guaranteed alloy content. And so, therefore, the question is, do you regulate based on the alloys that are most resistant to leaching cadmium or the ones that a child could potentially be exposed to? But you're right. Our data do show that there is quite a bit of variability. And as I indicated before, with cadmium, I've seen a lot more variability than the leaching with lead, the leaded jewelry items.
How many times would we have to run the test, the ASTM test, to be confident that it would pass or fail? How many times would you want to run the same sample, if you had replicates of it, to be confident in the result?
Okay, I heard part of that question. Could that be repeated to me?
How many times would you have to run the test to be confident in its result?
Well, I think it depends on the condition of the test. We did a half dozen of, each of those pieces because I was interested in, what is the, potential variability item to item. But more important than the number of pieces that would be tested, in my opinion, would be whether or not you're testing those items with or without damage to that outcoding.
All right. I think, can you hear me?
Yes.
I think it's got something to do with the pitch of your voice that he can hear. So our understanding of that is that there are pretty much multiple times before you would feel comfortable with the results of the amount of cadmium in the particular piece of jewelry.
So I think I heard the question as I'd be want to know that there were multiple tests on jewelry items. The answer is yes, that there would be need to be some multiple number of tests on an item, but also that there would need to be multiple number of tests on items that had been upgraded in some way, so that you got around this issue of an electroplated coating that might prevent in a non-abraded item prevent that release.
Thank you. And we now we have got that. We have two more questions that I know of, and I'm hoping you can hear. One is Ann Hulick. And you have to come over here, Ann.
Thank you, Dr. Wiedenhammer. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Just two very brief questions. You talked, I think I heard you say that in your testing you cut into the jewelry to distress it.
Yes.
Was that, I'm assuming, but I wanted to check, is that type of testing that you did with the cutting of the jewelry, would that be something that we would see a child being able to do that same level of interference or distressing with a typical piece of jewelry?
Well, we were doing that as a, you know, trying to get a handle on the, you know, the potential worst case scenario of, you know, I've seen children put jewelry in the mouth, and young children, their teeth are sharp. They can damage those items in some cases, from what I've seen, at least to the extent that we did. Now, we tried to come up with a standard way of doing it. Another way would be simply to cut the item in half. A child is not going to do that, but if you're wanting to get an idea of the maximum potential release of an item, that might be a way to do it also. But I'm not recommending that as a testing procedure. We were simply trying to come up with a way to get an idea of what that outcoding might do and what damage to that outcoding might do.
Okay, thank you. And just as a second question, I'm a nurse. I have a lot of experiences with children and children's behavior and children's health. And so I heard you say that cadmium is very bioaccumulative.
Yes.
And I'm not a chemist, is that, so I understand that bioaccumulative means that the cadmium can build up in a system and stay in a system over time. And
So the half-life in the body, cadmium tends to accumulate in the kidneys and in the bones. And so its half-life, depending on where it goes, can be as long as 20 to 30 years. So studies that I'm aware of that have been done indicate that cadmium builds up through a person's lifetime based on their intake. Typically, the effects occur in old age due to bone softening that can lead to bone fractures, renal issues that can lead to high blood pressure. So small exposures to children early in life could result in problems that wouldn't be seen for 30 or 40 or more years.
Yeah, that was my
concern here is that this would be avoidable.
That was my understanding, and my question was going to be, what is the half-life of cadmium? I thought it was quite long, but I didn't realize it was 20 to 30 years.
Depending on where it is in the body.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Senator Witkos, and if you can hear him, I'll talk for him.
Good afternoon, Doctor, or good evening on your side. Under the ASTM standard, that not only tests just jewelry but other products, is that correct?
Yes, I understand that there's a test. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and is it customary that they just use out-of-the-box, fresh, pristine products when they test, or would it not be part of their protocol to distress or simulate a wear and tear, if you're aware?
Well, as I mentioned, for other products, there are provisions in the ASTM standards for other products that mandate use of abuse testing. That's not the case in this for this standard, and that's one of my concerns about it.
Was there a reason given why not, if the the task force was a balanced approach from the consumers, the producers, and I forget the other faction that was there. Wouldn't somebody object to that and ask for that particular type of test to be done, or was there, do you, if you're aware through your contacts and colleagues, why it wasn't done?
I would have hoped that concern would have been raised at the time this was developed. I think my lab was the only one that had done that sort of testing.
Okay, and my last question, it just came up just a minute ago. Are you aware of there, is there any testing on older adults that might suffer from bone diseases or kidney failures to look at the cadmium levels at their age because of the technology of it being stored in the kidney and bones that you're aware of?
Yes, I will send a copy of the one review article that I mentioned on that. There are estimates that have been made based on epidemiological studies, and then the NHANES study that the National Institute of Health does is an estimate of exposure of Americans to a number of different toxins. And so there are some epidemiological studies available for that.
Great, thank
and
you.
And I can send that.
Thank you very much.
And I believe our final questioner is Brent Cleveland.
Doctor, good evening.
Hello.
Good evening. Can you hear
Hello?
Me?
Yes, I can.
Great, thank you. Well, let's see. To be formal on the record, we did have a phone conversation, I guess it was about a year ago, discussing the standard and all, so I just wanted to get that out. But the
yes.
The jewelry samples that you pulled in your letter to Representative Urban, you stated they were collected when?
The specific jewelry samples in the data that you have in front of you were did in 2008. The study was, but I have done subsequent testing of jewelry items. Collected through now this past year I have been on sabbatical in Australia, so I'm still out of the country and not returned yet, but you know, I've tested items collected through 2013, so I have continued to do other testing.
Well, thank you. And did you also test precious metal jewelry?
So no, the items that I have tested primarily are lower in cost, and I was doing that simply, you know, I did not have external support for this work, and so typically I was buying inexpensive jewelry items that are sold in discount stores of various types to see what was out there.
And are you aware that there's cadmium present in certain sterling and 14 karat gold jewelry?
Could you repeat that, Frank?
Are you aware that there is cadmium present in precious metal jewelry?
Yes, I am, and I know that it is a component of some solders, and that it is present at typically, you know, I have tested by X-ray fluorescence a number of finer jewelry items that you know, we've had brought into the lab. The cadmium levels you see in those jewelry items tend to be quite low. It's the inexpensive jewelry items that we can find these very high, enormously high concentrations of cadmium.
Well, and of course, these samples were pulled prior to the ASTM standard, and also this whole cadmium incident became public back in 2010. But specifically, a question on your sample. I see that you had three slipper charms here, and I
yes.
see the graph where you have discussed and shown the undamaged level and the damaged level. What component part were those graphs indicating?
So all of the testing was done on those slipper or flip-flop charms. I purchased multiple packages of those items once I had determined that those had high levels of cadmium. So I had multiple packages of those items.
Now, I see
that.
I'm sorry. It looks like some of them have paint or some of them have rhinestones and Was that the case?
Yes. Some of those have small little stones on them. Where I have pulled those off of those jewelry items, they tend to be the cadmium itself is not coming from those items. I've had on other items pulled those off separately and found that those really were not releasing anything in terms of cadmium content, that it was coming out of the metal itself.
But you didn't separate the component parts prior to the test?
No. And I did that because I was trying to test an item as a child might be exposed to it.
Great, thank you. Now, you also made a reference in your letter to early in life children, the impact of cadmium on children early in life. What years would you say that would cover?
Could you repeat that?
Well, you make this statement in the letter. The reference is made to the risk of children early in life.
Yes.
So do you mean that's two or?
That statement would be based on the fact that there's epidemiological data that the average exposure of Americans to cadmium through diet and that accumulates through a lifetime brings a significant fraction of the population up to what toxicologists would say a level that you can measure effects on kidney function in older adults. So therefore, if that is the case, additional exposures to cadmium that might be from consumer products such as jewelry that would be unnecessary would aggravate any problems caused by the existing levels of uptake of cadmium just through normal diet.
Right, but you were indicating earlier that there's greater risk of exposure to children.
Well, the risk of exposure is that the children are going to carry that with them through their life, but that cadmium is going to add to what they get normally. There is also, and again, I'm not a toxicologist. You would need to, consult toxicologists on this. Children tend to take up higher levels of toxic metals in terms of if you look at the fraction of cadmium that would be taken up by an adult and a child that would take in the same amount, children tend to take in a greater proportion of that, and it varies based on sex, based on age.
Okay, well, it's important to note that the ASTM F2923 standard does not recommend jewelry for children 3 and under. So, of course, the testing protocols that are in the standard would be for children 4 to 12. But as part of the fact gathering that the committee went through, we were testing plated samples with quality plating, with a not-so-quality plating, and even raw pieces to try to get the correlation between the substrate and what would be bioavailable. So we did test 1, 5, and 10% cadmium total content samples in that relationship. And I must say that our findings differed from yours. And, of course, the findings that I'm referring to are the CPSC test. But did you participate in a call with the CPSC to make your concerns on this known?
I heard most of that up to the last question. Did I?
Okay. Did you participate in a telephone conference with CPSC and other stakeholders?
I did participate in a phone call with Consumer Product Safety Commission staff regarding my concerns about this issue.
Yes, and what was the conclusion at the end of that call?
The conclusion was that the commission was, as I understand it, waiting for industry to develop a standard on this issue.
Yes, and of course, they found that the standards in the ASTM F2923 to be sufficiently health protective.
I also know that when I first contacted the commission, when I was first finding cadmium in jewelry at very high levels, I asked them what information I could provide them on the cadmium release, and I was told that they could really not do anything with any information I provided because there was no regulations at that point in time. I think the issue here is whether or not the ASTM standard is based on, you know, appropriate evaluation of all of the data. And, you know, my point in submitting the data I have is to point out that there is countervailing data that has not been considered.
Well, thank you. And I would like to say, too, that there's detailed studies of the migration of cadmium versus total content in the CPSC study, which has been distributed to the committee. So again, you know, there is all of this talk that has been underlying the tone of this whole conference of protecting children against, you know, exposure to this chemical. And I think it's important to realize that we are discussing the accidental ingestion of a component part of a piece of jewelry.
Mr. Cleveland, we are getting editorial at this point. This is informational. If you need information from Dr. Weidenheimer, ask him.
Great.
But editorializing is not appropriate at this time.
Thank you. Could you comment on that?
Well, I understand. We're talking about the accidental ingestion of a, you know, component piece of jewelry. So I do understand that. And the fact of the matter is, there is data that the CPSC has, that the CPSC has published on the number of trips made to emergency rooms by children for swallowing all sorts of items, screws, nails, and jewelry items. And so it is known that there are, I mean, swallowing these items is not a theoretical matter. It does happen. And so, I mean, I think it is a reasonable concern to ask, you know, how do we prevent unintended harm to kids who might swallow items such as this?
Great. Well, I thank you for your participation today. And just as an aside, do you know what the number one swallowed item is?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part there.
I was just making an aside comment. The number one swallowed item is coins. But
yes,
thank you for your time, and thank you for appearing here today.
We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us, and I'm sorry that the technology is not up to par, but we've gotten valuable information from you, Doctor, and we wish you much health and fun on your sabbatical. Wait, I have a question. What? Can you send us the Montreal Zagary studies?
Could you repeat that?
Can you send us the Montreal Zagary studies?
I'll send, you know, my personal copies of those papers to you.
Excellent. And the recent review, was that the same thing? No. And then in the beginning, the recent review, which tells us about the amount of cadmium and et cetera. Yes, you got that one. Perfect.
I'll do that.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Sure thing. You're welcome.
Angel. So we now have we're with our committee, so you can actually hear each other. With Dr. Weidenheimer, we had the Montreal Zagary studies. We had his beginning study, which I didn't catch the name of, but he knew what we were talking about, the recent review of kidney, bone, et cetera, damage. And we asked him, and he referred us, so this is still a question for the record, the difference between 75 parts per million and 300 parts per million to a toxicologist. So that would be a question for the record. And then in a discussion with Senator Witkos, he had asked me whether when we banned mercury, lead, hexavalent chromium, and cadmium from packaging materials in 1990, is that federal? Or did other states follow us? And I, being very candid, I do not know. So that, again, is a question for the record. And we will find out what other states have done and what the federal government is doing on that.
Madam Chairman, can I just add one other? I don't know if this is a question for the record or not, but I heard this twice. Is it the evidence that items could stay in a person's stomach longer than 24 hours? Is there anything? Professor gave us an example of a young boy in Minnesota that had this happen. I don't know if there's any other, if there's any way we can determine whether or not that's, you know, is a standard or a benchmark or something. So.
I'm afraid to talk. That is definitely a question for the record, and we will ask for further evidence on the amount of time that a charm or something that a child might have swallowed, the amount of time that could stay within the system. That's exactly what questions for the record are for. So thank you.
I too have a question for the record. He testified that there was a study about the types of things that children swallow in terms of the number of times they go to the emergency room. It said nails, coins, whatever. If we can get that information too, I think it would be helpful.
Consumer Product Safety Commission would have that study, CPSC, we think. With that, my co-chair and I are happy that we will be having our meeting next week, and at that point we'll be having some discussion as to future meetings and how we're going to proceed. My co-chair wants to talk.
For next week, we have a couple of other names that were suggested by task force members, and what we're finding is that this tends to be last minute, trying to coordinate schedules and everything else. So it could be that we have another couple of speakers, but if we don't, personally I think it might be a good time to reflect for a little while and just have a general discussion about what we think are the most important issues that we've heard, so that we can focus on those issues that help us. And I've also heard from some members that when we hit August, we're going to be running into vacation schedules. So when the chairs sit down, it's possible that we may have a bit of a hiatus before the next meeting, after the next one. There may be a little bit of a gap of time in August because we want as many people to participate as possible. But we will get back to you. And again, I would encourage anybody, if you have suggested speakers, let us know. We did not get many names. So if you have others, we don't want to be repetitious. But if you feel there's somebody who can add a dimension we haven't heard, certainly we'd like to hear from them.
With that, I would say that the appointments to the task force are rapidly getting filled, and we should be at full force. And again, I'm very grateful that CTN has done both these. So anyone that was unable to be here has the opportunity to watch on CTN. So thank you, CTN. And thank you to our committee clerk, Angel. You did a phenomenal job to get us Skyping. And, of course, Liz from the Children's Committee is diligently keeping our questions for the record. So with that, I would adjourn the meeting.